yeah, we're all set. We're going to be hitting the road. Actually, tomorrow morning at about 5 o'clock, I'm going to do that thing where you get the kids out of bed and they're bleary-eyed and can't put up a fight. Throw them into the back of the car where they're going to fall asleep immediately and hit the gas.
Oh, boy.
That way, I don't know whether you do this. This is a great parenting tip if you've ever done a road trip with small kids. And my kids are older, but I still do it. You get as much mileage in the first part of the trip by getting them to fall asleep. You get them up early in the morning, put them in the back seat, and just run. That time, by the time they can wake up and start fussing, like, I want to pull over, I want to eat, I got to go to the bathroom, are we there yet? You're at least a good chunk down the road.
That's funny. You know why that's funny to me? Because I was the youngest of seven kids, and we would drive across country every summer for our big trip, and we'd go to the East Coast and visit relatives. And my dad, every summer, the morning we were going to leave to go back to Massachusetts, he would be like, all right, we're leaving at 5. Everybody be ready. Alarm clock's going to go off. We'll leave at 5. But this is the amazing part. With seven kids, we would leave at noon every time because there was no way.
Your poor dad. I can just see that guy just trying desperately. This is going to be the year we leave at 5 o'clock or at least before the sun is in the top of the sky.
It is literally the definition of herding cats. Like, oh, we forgot the best suitcase. Oh, Patrick forgot his shoes. Oh, David wanted us to go back and get his baseball glove. Like, nothing was packed at the right time.
You literally get to that point where you go, does she really need clothes on this trip? We'll pick her up a t-shirt at the bridge.
It'll
Come
be
on.
Fine.
There's got to be a Goodwill somewhere between here and there. We'll pick her up some stuff.
My favorite follow-up memory to that was like being at the Grand Canyon. I was like 10, and my dad, bless his heart, had gotten like a new Canon camera, and he was looking across with his zoom lens across the Grand Canyon. I go, hey, Dad, can I look through the camera too?
Oh,
and you both can see where this is going. Down the side of the Grand Canyon, I dropped his brand new Canon camera. And the look on my dad's face, was just like, oh, man. All right, let's go back to the van.
That was my one bit of fun for the summer. Gone.
Yeah, like his one treat was like, I'm going to get myself a Canon camera and I'll enjoy so much
and
for that.
And here I am at picturesque spot in the United States, the Grand Canyon. I'm going to have beautiful photos to remember this trip by.
Well, and also my asshole brothers and sisters, as it's literally falling a mile down into the ground, going, wow, look at it bounce.
It's still falling.
Look at it go. Wow, it's making a little avalanche as it goes. Look at that, Dad. Hey, Dad,
still?
That's your $500 camera.
And if they're anything like my brothers and sisters, like 3 hours later, you'd be in the car driving. It would be quiet, and somebody would go, I bet you that camera is still falling.
Well, so, Brad, though, you going on this trip actually raises a good point. This will be fun to talk about with Katie. So how do you, because you're this, ostensibly, you're going to, quote, unquote, get work done, quote, on this trip. How are you going to pack for, prepare, and get work done in a, where are you, Alabama? Where are you going?
Alabama, well, Michigan.
But different.
Just like Alabama, but with cold weather. No, actually, my August is horrible. This week, I'm going up to spend with my family in Michigan for about a week and a half. And then we come home. We're home for a few days. And then I drive my younger son, just he and I, down to Alabama for NASA space camp. I'm going to hole up for a week in a hotel and work. But both trips, I kind of handle the same way. I take, I've got a Cintiq Wacom that's built for travel. In fact, it's the one I use all the time anyway, because it's Scott Kurtz had bequeathed it to me when I went full time as a cartoonist. He says, I used to use this for conventions and I don't anymore. Maybe you'd enjoy it, you know, that type of thing. And so I liked it so much, I've got two of them now, one for the house and one for the studio. So I've got that, a little Mac Mini, and all the cords and wires and stuff that go along with all of that. And and really in my sketchbook that I've got story ideas and scripting written down in, and I will probably the Michigan trip, I will set that up and maybe like in the mornings before anybody's awake, get online and, you know, do things like update webcomics.com, check in on my sites, maybe get some drawing done. But it's hard. It's hard. The Alabama trip will be a lot easier because I'll have an entire week where I'm doing nothing but sitting in a hotel room. And I usually get a ton of work done because I did that last year and I got way ahead. Michigan, I don't expect to get a whole lot done. It'll be a little bit here, a little bit there.
Well, and in good news, you're going to two places in America famous for their pleasant August, Michigan and Alabama.
Yeah.
Nothing like the cooling breezes of Michigan and Alabama in August.
Man.
And bugs. Yeah.
Well, and I don't know whether this resonates with people, but there's this place that we used to go. It's like trying to capture your childhood. When we were little kids, my mom and dad would take us to a cabin by a lake in Michigan called Floyd Lake. And it was like a friend of our grandparents had this cabin. And since we were friends, they'd say, well, oh, you can use it for this week, you know, and they would let friends rent out the cabin. They never charged us anything. And it was the biggest vacation we ever took was to this cabin. And I have such amazing memories of fishing on this lake and just being by the water. There was no TV. There was no nothing. Mm-hmm. You sat and played cards and read books. And it was some of the most purely joyous times of my life. And me and my brothers are on a tear now to try and find, we're sure that the cabin doesn't stand there anymore. And we've tried to like find these people that were connected to our grandparents through property records and stuff, and nobody can find them. We've all lost touch. So we're just going to drive out there and using our memories from the time that we were like 10 years old, try to find where this cabin used to stand.
Dang.
We're on a mission. Me, especially my, I'm the oldest, and then Brian, who's 13 months younger than I am. We both have the most clearest memories, and we're both like obsessed with driving out there. It's not that far away. It's a good day trip type of deal. Driving out there and seeing if we can find a place that isn't there anymore.
Cut to you and your brothers taking the turns that you remember from 10 years old, ending up in Saskatchewan. Like, I'm sure this is it. This has got to be it.
We're pouring through Google Map aerial views. And it's like, I remember it used to have this little lagoon by the side, and there's only one place on this map that has what looks like a lagoon, and maybe that's it. And
oh, this is great though, Brad, because if there's a place in the world that has very few lakes and lagoons, it's Michigan. So this is great.
It can only be one place.
Brad, this is a can't lose scenario. There's no way you're going to get lost looking for a lake in Michigan.
I am now really excited that I get the chance to talk to you before you leave.
Yeah, because you may never hear from me again.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly.
Katie, this is absolutely the time we say goodbye to Brad as a person. Well, speaking of that third voice, before, because I still wanted to talk about work trips, but I want to introduce this delightful third tone on our conversation. So I'm going to say, welcome everybody to Comic Lab, the show about making comics.
And making a living from comics. I'm Brad Geiger, editor of webcomics.com and cartoonist of Evil Inc.
And I'm Dave Kellett, cartoonist of Drive and Sheldon and co-director of Stripped.
And this week's Hour of Comics Advice is made possible by your support at patreon.com/comiclab. And Dave, who's that other person?
Well, it's not only my favorite lawyer in the world, it's also one of my favorite people. It's Katie Aww. Lane, everybody.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for having me on. So I'm excited to do this.
Katie Lane, so that everyone can know, or who might not know, can go look right away. You can find her at a couple different places online. First and foremost, workmadeforhire.com, right, Katie? Not dot net.
It's dot net.
Oh, it is dot net.
It is very much dot net. But that was good that you intentionally made the mistake so that we could emphasize the difference. I appreciate that.
Yeah, now I've made it a mnemonic, and so people can't forget. So workmadeforhire.net. And if you look over on Skillshare, she's got an amazing new project it's contracts for creative freelancers. If you search on Skillshare for contracts for creative freelancers, a series of classes. And I'm very excited to hear you talk about that later in the show. But more important than anything else, how's my buddy Katie doing?
I'm doing pretty well. I'm excited to talk to you guys. I don't get to talk to you every day, so that's a real treat. And now I get to say goodbye to Brad.
I know, right?
This will be nice. We'll have this to remember.
No, it's really, if there's one thing that a 10-year-old memory is, the memory right, of a 10-year-old yeah. is good for, is the street turns that mom and dad took 40 years ago.
Especially if you started out at 5 o'clock in the morning when you were still asleep, so that you couldn't, you know, so that your parents had some time to be quiet with each other and get on the road. Yeah, no, your memory is going to be perfect. It's going
to
be great.
Well, and especially if you've grown up to be a quote unquote adult who has zero sense of direction. Like I've got no, like I forget about remembering from 10 years old. I'm 49 now. And I was driving my older son home from Amherst, Massachusetts, where he went to Ultimate Frisbee Camp. And something went nutty with my iPhone over the George Washington Bridge. And Google Maps just like was just psychotic. It was telling me to make turns that weren't there. And you'd think that I was on 95 South. 95 South runs right into Philadelphia. I still got lost.
Oh, my God.
Is there a tracker we could give you before you leave? Like, is there...
So, Katie, here's what I'm hearing.
Breadcrumbs or something?
Yeah. Brad, last night I was helping my 80-year-old father log into his iPad, and he used the exact same phrasing that you just used, so I just want to forewarn you. David, it's gone haywire. I don't know what's going on over here. David, I put in my password. Dad, you just typed it into Google. No, I put it in. I put in my password.
Dave, I think it's a little bit weird to have a co-host who's a lawyer. But I look forward for taking over for Brad during the hiatus. I think it's going to be really
she
fun.
Makes her move already. What minute mark are we at? 13 minutes, and Katie's making her move.
I, for one, welcome someone who knows how to read Google Maps. So thank you, Katie, for co-hosting with me.
Goodness.
So, okay, now let's get real, because here's what happens for me every time I go on any trip where I'm like, I'm going to get some work done. I start packing things up. I'm like, I'm going to bring these kinds of paper. Oh, you know what? I'm going to also bring my watercolors. Oh, and I'll bring this local small computer. I'll bring that too. Might want to bring my iPad so I can log in on the go. Oh, and I'll bring my phone. I'm going to bring all these chargers. And then nothing gets done that trip.
Nope.
Like the whole trip is just a series of failures of me not pulling any of that stuff out.
The more I overpack, the less work I will do. The more optimistic I am about all of the different projects I will get done, the less work that actually gets accomplished.
Oh,
actually,
that's intriguing.
I get a lot accomplished on these things. I'll tell you what I accomplish. I'll do what Dave just described. I'll take everything, and then I'll accomplish the following. I'll lose my iPhone charger on the way there. I'll lose my iPad charger at the rest stop, and I'll come home with half the stuff that I left.
Good,
wow,
good.
We're really getting an image into Brad Geiger's grandpa world, aren't we?
Yeah.
Go on vacation with Brad. Lose all your shit.
It's an adventure.
I got to tell you, though, I'm still laughing at the fact that, like, we remember the lagoon so clearly. There's no way we can't find that.
Well, it had a shape to it. It's hard
for
to
God's
explain.
Sakes. Brad, that's not how you find things. I still remember the tree I climbed near it. Oh, it was a beautiful tree. It had a nice soft stump that you could sit on. Oh, it was a great tree. I'm sure that tree is still there 40 years later. This is going to be easy.
And this was a small cabin. I mean, there's going to be no visual landmark at all. I'm almost certain they would have torn this thing down and put up something like a McMansion or something there long time ago. But we're going to have nothing to go by. I've not been looking forward to anything as much as this for a long time.
Brad,
this is
I'm
like
lighting
a
candle for you. I know. I'm not Catholic, but I'm considering saying a couple rosaries. Come on, man.
Anything can help at this point, Katie.
Yeah. So I have a question that is not about getting lost, but is about Brad's sort of you, Brad, you were describing that you have a Travel Cintiq and a Mac Mini.
Yeah. Yeah.
So one of the things I've noticed in traveling with a cartoonist is that if you don't have the right cord, you know, which is not easily reproduced because the owner of the various devices has dictated what the connector is going to be. But if you don't have one of those cords, you can have all of your stuff and still not be able to get anything done. So how do you make sure that you have all of the cords that you need for the machines that you are taking? Do you have like a go bag, a checklist? Like, what do you do?
I when I used to do conventions all the time, I would literally print out a checklist.
Okay.
For this, now you're making me nervous because I don't have a system other than being fidgety and a little bit OCD. In other words, I'll probably check it and recheck it and recheck it before I leave. But I don't have anything close to a system other than, like, when I do it, I just try to really, really pay attention and not get distracted by shiny objects so that I do everything I need to do.
I'm telling you, this trip is a can't lose. This is a can't lose for Brad. There's no way a thing is going to go wrong. This is amazing.
No, I may have to take my microphone and report in on Tuesday at our regular recording time and just give you an update with everything that's been going on.
Can I echo Brad's answer to Katie's question? Because I think this is a good one. Because I just got done doing San Diego Comic-Con, and this is actually worth sharing. You will save yourself a ton of time exhibiting at any point in the next 5 years, if you write down everything that you wrote in an Excel checklist or a Word checklist or however you want to do it, just so that even 5 years from now, if all your wires have changed, you know to look for them and on your checklist. It's having a checklist for a comics convention or any traveling event for a cartoonist is so helpful. And so I can't recommend that enough. Just save it somewhere in the background of your computer. And Brad, I will even share my checklist for San Diego Comic-Con. Because it's now the full length of an 11 by 17 piece of paper is my checklist.
Oh my gosh.
Cats.
That's how big that checklist is.
How many things is it covering?
Everything. And I have it broken up by segments. So I'll have like physical things that I need at the convention, marketing and PR things that I need at the convention, merch that I'm selling.
Yeah,
I'll need.
That's what I meant. I was curious, like, is it just covering things to pack, or is it also the things you have to do? It sounds like it's everything.
Yeah, it's everything, because I've gotten to conventions in the past where everything is there except for whatever reason, my book five, you know, like, and it drives you nuts when that happens. So, yeah, and what's nice is I've set up the list so that when I do a traveling show, there's a subset that, like, take these on a traveling show, take these on a show you can drive to. And so it makes it really easy to do.
One thing that I will suggest is that I used to do when I was going to a lot of conventions is I had a convention briefcase, and I just stocked that briefcase so that I put a bunch of stuff in it that I knew I would need at different times, like a spare toothbrush, a toothpaste, breath mints. As you can tell, I'm very, you know, orally fixated, but also Band-Aids and, you know, maybe an Ethernet wire and Post-it notes and markers. And I would just stock this briefcase. And you'd get one of those briefcases with lots of pockets and stuff and business cards. And once you got that stocked once, once you grab that briefcase, you're prepared with a bunch of incidentals. You don't have your books or your flyers or anything, but once you have that briefcase in hand, you know that you're a little bit prepared for a whole lot of everything.
Yeah, I used to have when I would do speaking engagements where it was less likely that they were going to have a setup ready for me to use, I had a bag that was just the cords that I needed to connect to various projectors, and it had like an extra remote in there. And I mean, those cords and those items were cheap enough that I could afford to have a separate travel case of them. But because I had that separate travel case and that, like, I had adapters, but because I had that separate bag cords and equipment, I knew I could just grab it and I would be fine for whatever happened on the trip.
Yep.
Yeah, that's smart.
And that's a peace of mind.
I have to say, though, if you at all ever want a date in your life, I think maybe don't go the briefcase route. Go maybe the go bag route that Katie suggested. I think, but only if you ever want to smooch another human being. Maybe just don't go with a briefcase. But that's just my pro tip for the week. That's...
What if it's a leather briefcase, but you like write go bag on the side of it? Does that
in duct tape? That's yeah. Sure went over someone's heart. I'm sure that's yeah. I just, you know, in terms of, but if you don't mind ever looking attractive to any other human being, I think a briefcase is the way to go.
Yeah. No, wait a minute. What's wrong with a briefcase? I looked really good walking up and down hotel concourses with my briefcase.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. Uh-huh. Well, let me ask you, I think Katie and I are both curious. Were you already married at this point?
Oh, God, yes. Listen, thank God that the marriage had already been like cemented. Yep. By the time I started doing comics. I don't think I would have gotten very far otherwise.
Yeah, I don't think the briefcase would have helped. That's,
no,
that's,
I would not have. I would have not have been very good otherwise. No.
So I want to circle back on, before we forget this, move on from this topic, I want to circle back on one other thing that Katie said, because I like this idea, the idea that like you don't pack for everything, you pack for one mm-hmm. thing, and then you try to just get the one thing done on the trip. Is that the idea?
Yeah. Dylan's family has a cabin out on the beach. Dylan's my wife, Dylan McConus. She's lovely. They have a cabin out on the beach, and we've gone out there a couple times for like an extended period of time to try to get some work done and also relax. I hear it's a thing. And what I noticed on those trips was the more, because I'm always optimistic, right? I always think, I'm going to have free time. I'm not going to, like, there's no internet access out there and cell service is really bad. So I know I'm not going to be stuck just answering emails or doing that administrative stuff that I always feel is taking me away from my quote unquote real job. And mm-hmm. so I would always plan like these huge elaborate lists of projects that I was going to be able to accomplish. And inevitably I would get there and, oh, it's really nice to read a book or go on a walk on the beach. And then, oh, I got to work, but I've got so many things to choose from. How am I going to, I'm going to take a nap. And when I wake up, I'll, you know, like I need a really limited choice when it comes to working. I need to have an idea of what I'm going to try to accomplish. And Dylan is always trying to convince me to make my list shorter. And I'm always trying to convince her that that's really not long enough. So what I've learned is I listen to my wife. She's right. And the fewer things I try to put on that list, the more I'll actually get done, because I'm not spending time deciding what to do or feeling bad about not having gotten to that thing, or, you know, doing a little bit here, doing a little bit there, but not actually making enough progress in any one area.
Gotcha. And now you're already married, but what is your stance on bringing a briefcase on the trip?
I do not bring a briefcase. I actually no longer own any briefcases.
I'm gonna post a photo mm-hmm. on for our Patreon backers of my
sure.
briefcase.
Sure.
And when you guys see it, you're gonna say, "Oh, I get what he's talking about. This is
Brad,
super cool."
Understand? I've had a briefcase in the past. I've had a briefcase from
well, yeah,
France.
Yeah, but you're a lawyer.
That
you probably
I love.
Had actual briefs
it's
in them.
It's still a bad idea.
I like how Brad is pitching it as though, like, you guys are going to see this photo of me carrying this briefcase, and those wedding rings are going to come right off. They're going to come right off.
Oh, my God.
You wait, so it's you some wait great and object. See. You'll be sorry.
I like how a third of the show has become about Brad's briefcase.
Brad getting lost with his briefcase in Alabama or Michigan.
That's okay, because there's
right.
a compass
yeah,
in
that's
it.
Right. But we found the lagoon. It's just a lake. We found the lagoon, Brad. It's just a lake. So, all right. Well, let's talk about your past briefcase holding days, because this I'm realizing we did not do a suitable enough job to in introducing you. So as a lawyer to the cartoonist stars, you have represented both Brad and I and many mm-hmm. of our cartoonist friends in many contractual reviews or contract creation moments.
Yep.
But what was your journey? How did you fall into being a wonderful and delightful cartoonist, lawyer that every cartoonist loves?
Oh, I like that question better than how did you become a lawyer, because it's just how you became a lawyer is just sad. I used to do theater, and I really liked being involved in theater and being involved in, you know, making art. But I also realized pretty quickly I wasn't going to make that my career. I didn't have the stamina for it. So I went to law school with the full intent that I would be able to work with creators and help them better understand the law, better understand contracts, better understand intellectual property, so that they felt like they had actual genuine guidance, as opposed to this is what it says for small businesses that, you know, are insurance companies, and that's not exactly me, but I'm gonna like jam it in here and see if I can make it fit, and oh, it didn't quite fit, so I'm gonna take this advice from, you know, this totally different industry and see if I can make that work. What I found at the time that I went to law school was a lot of the advice that was available for artists was either for artists who had already made it, right? Like you had landed a couple big gigs. You were now making a good amount of money. You had representation.
You
have briefcases. You have like a collection of briefcases. Everybody loves your briefcases. You get lost in Michigan on a regular basis. You've made it, right? And that kind of advice is different, and it's not really helpful to apply when you're just starting out. So I wanted to be able to work with people who are maybe earlier in their career, middle of their career, doing, you know, a lot of those people are doing really well, but the advice is still a little bit different from, I just landed a $1 million contract and, have a gallery show at, you know, a famous museum, that sort of thing. So yeah, I've been doing this for longer than I can imagine, but I love it. I love helping people figure this stuff out.
Well, and what I like about you is that not only do you approach it with kindness and joy, but you do a wonderful job, and it's very much a giving back scenario, is that both in the moment of being hired and even outside of it in a public setting, you are a teaching lawyer and a sharing lawyer, and instructive to other people about how the law works and how they can approach it and how they can implement it in their own careers. And I think that is super admirable just in terms of being a wonderful person. And you should be rewarded for that by being given ice cream. I don't know. I don't know where that was going.
No, thank you. I really appreciate that, because it's important to me that I am teaching, right? Like, I don't think this knowledge should be held back from people. It is knowledge that you need in order to do your job, to build your career. And there is no reason why it should be trapped in my head. You might not be able to do everything on your own, but if you understand how things work, when you work with an attorney, you'll be able to be a better collaborator with them. You'll be able to be more involved. You're not going to have to just hope that they're giving you the advice that you need. You can ask questions. You can tell them what you want. You can participate in brainstorming. And that's really important to me. So thank you.
Well, and that raises a question that I wanted to ask you, Katie, because Brad and I obviously would recommend Katie for any and all lawyer in needs that cartoonists might have. So that's
absolutely
first and foremost over at workmadeforhire.net. But in general, philosophically, how does a cartoonist who might have never hired a lawyer before go about looking for and hiring a lawyer? I mean, what are the questions you ask? What are the things you look for in their resume or on their self-descriptions? How does one go about doing the basics of looking for a lawyer?
Sure. I think the piece of advice that I give everybody is to talk to your peers. So talk to other folks that are working in comics and ask them, who have you used in the past? Did you like them? Mm-hmm. Were they helpful? Did you feel like it was a good value? Because you'll get the best information from a personal referral, because that person has experience with the attorney, so that they can actually tell you what it is like to work with them. But if you don't have if you don't have peers who have hired an attorney before, or the attorneys that you've contacted with aren't available, The thing that I would look for is, first, you want to look for a transactional attorney. That means that's somebody who is creating documents and doing deals, as opposed to somebody who is going into courtrooms and pursuing lawsuits. So you want a transactional attorney who is focusing on intellectual property law. Intellectual property law are things like copyrights, trademarks, patents. Really, you want somebody who's specializing in the copyright and trademark end of intellectual property law, because they're going to have more experience with licensing, which is essentially what publishing is. Publishing is you giving permission to the publisher to produce your work. Licensing is also what happens when merchandise is made. You giving permission to the printmaker or the toy maker to make something based off of your work and sell it. So you want somebody who has that level of experience. It's great if they have experience in publishing or comics in particular, because both of those industries are kind of weird and wacky from a legal perspective, but it's not absolutely necessary. And once you know that you have somebody who has those basic technical skills in place, then you want to talk to them. What are they like to talk with? Are they open to questions? Do they try to dictate how the conversation is going to go, or what is available to you? Do you feel comfortable asking them questions? Because having an attorney is, you're going to be trusting this person with some intimate information, and you're going to be involving them in helping you make decisions that are really important to you and your career and your work. And so you want somebody that you feel comfortable talking with. You want somebody that you feel like you can trust. And I think that the best way of doing that is getting on the phone with them or meeting them in person and talking to them for a little while. Most lawyers won't charge for that. And if you find somebody who is insisting on charging for an initial like meet and greet meeting, I would say keep looking, because that is not as common in my area of the law as it is in, say, like a lot of family law attorneys will charge for the initial consultation. So I would say, you know, get out there and talk to a couple people and pick the person that you feel best talking with.
And as a lawyer, is there worth at all in seeing where they went to school, what their background was, what firms they might have worked with before they went independent? Does that matter as a lawyer? Does that matter to you when you're looking for an attorney?
It's a good question. It doesn't matter to me, but that sort of thing has never really mattered to me. It's not something that I have focused on in my career. And so it's not something that I focus on when I am looking at other attorneys. I tend to evaluate them the same way I've just described. What is their actual experience like? What do people who have worked with them say about working with them? What kind of questions are they asking? How do they answer questions when we're talking? And those things tell me more about them than, you know, where they went to law school, whether or not they were on Law Review, that sort of thing.
Right. Well, one last question on that vein is, how much should or shouldn't you judge them based on the briefcase that they own?
That is a very important characteristic. If it's not the right briefcase, you don't want to trust them.
if you open up their briefcase and it has actual jockey briefs in there, you know you've got the wrong person.
You should run in the other direction.
it's just a stick of gum, foot powder, and like an old tennis ball.
And a cord to some machine that no longer exists.
Right. And a Cintiq that Brad doesn't own anymore.
It's an old SCSI cord from the old days, if you remember those SCSI's cords. Here's the deal. I'm glad that you're talking about this, because it's really important that we suggest to people that like maybe they're in a situation where they are building a collaboration, they need to put a contract down, or they're going to do some work for an entity and they're being handed a contract. And to get this idea across of having a legal mind give them advice on this, rather than it is important to try to understand this stuff yourself, but to get somebody who really knows their stuff, because there's a lot of nuance in this stuff that we're talking about. And I'll give you a good example, Katie, and you can tell me what you think. We always warn, as artists, we always warn people about work for hire contracts, right? Mm-hmm. Because in a work for hire contract, the holder of the contract owns the entire copyright of the finished product, not the person that created it. All right. In other words, you give up your copyright immediately to the person holding the contract. And we always say, don't hire a work for hire contract. Don't sign that contract. But there are some cases when you might suggest that this is a good idea for somebody,
it
correct?
It can be perfectly acceptable to do that because you don't actually need to own the copyright to everything you do to be successful. Mm-hmm. Copyright lasts for an incredibly long period of time. And it attaches
longer and longer every year.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you, Disney. And it attaches immediately as the thing is created. So owning the image that you created for some corporate gig isn't necessary as long as that's not going to get in the way of you being paid. It's not going to get in the way of you having a successful time doing the project itself. The other thing that work for hire can be really good for is being able to play with other people's toys. Like there are certain collaborations you can't participate in if you're insisting on owning the copyright to all of your work because you're writing a story for somebody else's characters or you're drawing a story that somebody else has started. And in those situations, it might not make sense for you to own that work because the other person has a large body of work. It's like nobody who draws or writes for Batman owns any intellectual property in what they are creating. Because that all belongs to somebody else and there's a big wide world. So in those situations where you get to experiment and play with somebody else's toys, work for hire can totally make sense. Again, as long as you're getting paid appropriately and you're getting paid on time and you're being treated with respect, it's perfectly fine to do work for hire.
That's the key to a work for hire contract for me is that you've got to get paid. When you say appropriately, I would put a little nuance to that, say get paid a lot up front if you're going to sign a work for hire contract.
A lot is appropriately.
Well, here's my point. You've only got one shot at getting paid with a work for hire contract. So that check has to be enough to cover everything you expect to make because you're not making anything else later on down the road. So you've got to make sure that initial payment is sufficient for what you want it to be.
Yeah, and the way that I think about that is when you are doing work for hire work, you are providing the client not only your labor and skill and talent in what it is that you're creating, but you're also providing them the rights to that work. So they are two separate things of value. And so you should be compensated for both of those things of value. The other thing I would say to folks who are maybe writing comics and wanting to hire artists, but wanting to hire them on a work for hire basis, you can do that and still create a respectful document where the artist gets to benefit down the road. Just because it's work for hire doesn't mean you can't have royalties baked into the contract. You have to make sure that you can afford those royalties, but there's no reason why you can't have a work for hire contract that allows the creator to benefit if the comic or the project is successful. So that's the other thing is you can be creative when you are coming up with a work for hire term if you are working with an attorney who is willing to be creative with you. If they're only willing to do things by rote, this is the way I do it, so that's just the way you're going to get it. That's not as helpful in an industry like comics.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
So let's talk, you talked about rights and that you're giving and exchanging in a contract. Here's one that comes up an awful lot that I'd like to get your impression of, and that is the right of first refusal in a contract. In other words, you're signing over your property, your comic, and for example, a publisher might have right of first refusal on any books you might come out with. And what that says is, if a different publisher wants to do a book, you've got to take it to the right of first refusal holder first and give them an opportunity to match that offer. And a lot of people sign right of first refusal contracts thinking that that's perfectly okay. And then we have a lot of horror stories of people whose property gets wrapped up because there's a lot of nuance to a right of first refusal contract, correct?
There's a lot of nuance to contracts, full stop. And just to be clear, they're fiddly little things. It's part of the reason that I like them so much. I am a fiddly person. I like details and nuance. And so contracts are genuinely fun for me, but I get that they're not fun for everybody. One thing that I want to make clear, though, since we were just talking about work for hire, a right of first refusal is not going to come up in a work for hire agreement because you don't own any rights in the work. Therefore, you can't license that work to somebody else later on. You just don't have that ability. So a right of first refusal is going to come up in an agreement where you own the copyright to the work and you are giving permission to somebody else to do something with it. So let's take your example. We've got a publisher who publishes comics online. And you're giving them permission to publish your comics digitally. And the contract details out what's going to happen, how you're going to get paid. And then it has a section about a right of first refusal. And it says that if you decide to publish the comic in print, you're going to give them this right of first refusal. This basically it's the first shot at being able to get the rights to publish it in print. One of the things that happens with contracts is you've had a conversation with the other person or a representative from the company about what is going on. They've explained the contract to you in rough terms. And so as you're reading the contract, you are making assumptions based on that conversation and based on your understanding of the industry. Assumptions are really dangerous when it comes to contracts because you have to make sure that you're making the assumption that everybody else would make. And that is not a thing that happens with assumptions, right? You want the right of first refusal to be detailed about, okay, before you can sign a deal with somebody else to publish the book in print, you've got to bring it back to the digital publisher and they've got to have a first job stab at it. How long do they have to review the contract and make a decision? Is it 30 days? Yeah. Is it 60 days? Is it not mentioned? Do they just have to meet the financial terms? Or does the deal as a whole have to be very similar to what the other publisher is promising? Because there's a big difference between I will pay you, you know, a $2,000 advance and promise you an 8% royalty on sales if I am like Random House Penguin, whatever their name is these days. If I'm a large publisher versus a small independent publisher who is only focused digitally and online, has not had experience with print, that as a small digital publisher, I might be able to make the same financial promise to you, but the deals are going to be fundamentally different because I don't have the resources that the larger publisher has to get the book out there, to market it, to actually get the book in stores and get booksellers to buy it, to sell it to customers. So what does it say about matching? Is it purely financial or are we looking at this more holistically? And then what happens if the digital publisher passes? There are a number of contracts now that are giving them basically first and last bite at the apple. So not only do I have to take it back to the digital publisher, and I'm not picking on any particular digital publisher, this is just an easy way of talking about it. Not only do I have to bring it back to the digital publisher for the right of first refusal, but I also have to bring it back to them for something called last negotiation. So I bring it to them for right of first refusal. They pass. I negotiate a deal, a full deal, with my random puffin candle publisher, whatever their name is. I negotiate the full deal with them. But before I can sign it, I've got to come back to the digital publisher and give them one more chance to make a play for the material. And that's the one that I find really frustrating. That actually happens more in entertainment contracts than it does in publishing agreements. But that puts that company in a ton of control over what happens with your material, because they can kind of just sit back and wait. You have to do all the work, and you have to negotiate a deal with somebody who knows that once you've settled on those terms, you're taking them back to somebody else and giving them the opportunity to potentially pull the rug out from underneath them. And that sucks.
So they don't have any real impetus to do good faith contract negotiations with you, because they know that you're operating under this other contract and everything's going to go out the window anyway.
Well, and it depends. I mean,
well, and let's say,
go ahead.
Even if they're operating in good faith, let's say they've negotiated with you knowing that you have to take it back to this other company. But sometimes there's a time limit on when these things can be done.
Totally.
And so if you don't get it done by today, or if you don't get it done, especially in entertainment, if you don't get it done by this week, then having to go back and whatever, as Katie was saying, whatever term limits or time limits they have, like 2 weeks, 3 weeks to review and counter, that can put the kibosh on a deal.
Totally.
Maybe not so much in publishing, but in entertainment, definitely, you know.
Time is a really important factor in a situation of right of first refusal. For example, if you don't have a time limit listed in your right of first refusal, you could have a print publisher say, we want to print your book. You come to the digital publisher that holds the right of first refusal contract, and they say, oh, no, we're going to match that. If you don't have a time limit, they can just say, yeah, we're going to match it sometime this year. Mm-hmm. And then you've got to go back to that interested publisher, say, nope, they're not freeing me. They're going to do a book. You come back to them a year later and you say, hey, where's my book? And they said, yeah, we kind of forgot about that. and now it's a year has elapsed. You can't go back to that interested publisher because they've moved on to somebody that they can do business with. They've long since forgotten about you, and they're not going to give you a second chance. And this publisher who holds the right of first refusal contract has no real impetus to do business. And basically, you're screwed.
Yes. Right? Yay. Positivity.
Well, that's what I don't like about this stuff. I get really scared when I hear people like, oh, yeah. Oh, and here's another one I want, because this came up in a conversation just recently. You've signed a right of first refusal contract, and I don't remember what the details were, but we'll just consider it like a boilerplate. What happens in the case of a Kickstarter? What if you want to kickstart a book? How do you handle a right of first refusal in a situation like that?
Well, you would talk to the publisher and you would say, hey, I want to do this thing, and this is how I'm going to do it. You don't have the infrastructure right now to do it for me, so I'm going to go ahead and do this. Do you want to exercise?
No,
do you want to exercise your right of first refusal? You take it from there. I think one of the things you said, Brad, I hear a lot from people, which is this really scares me. And I would say that most contract terms out of context are really scary, because the lawyer who wrote them is trying to anticipate the future and come up with a process for everybody to follow if this particular thing happens. So it is all anxiety-driven writing. I tell people that part of the reason that lawyers are so fussy is because our JD came with a generalized anxiety disorder. We were taught...
that got me.
But we were basically taught, like, you have to anticipate the future and plan for things so that your client never ever has to deal with any sort of pain or frustration. And if they do, you then have to be able to bring the biggest tool in your briefcase and protect them. and that just creates this approach to deal making that is, I think, very anxious and not particularly helpful. But what I will say is, you have to look at those terms in context of who's going to be exercising them. And are they going to actually have a self-interest, a reason for exercising that term? In a lot of cases, the answer is no. Like, one that always gets people is when you're doing print publishing, the publisher owns the rights to the work forever or until the book goes out of print. And recently, out of print has been defined more in terms of sales than it is actual having physical copies in print. And people get really, really anxious that the publisher may just do another print run in order to keep the rights to the book. You know, they haven't made very many sales, but they're just going to order another print run to be able to keep the rights. That is incredibly expensive. If they have not been selling your book for an extended period of time, the only reason they're going to want to do that is if they believe they can make money off of spending that money. Or, you know, they want to keep it from somebody else. But I think it's less common for that to be the motivation to keep it from somebody else than it is to look at it and say, oh no, I can still make money off of this. And I need this to make money because when I planned for the investment, I saw a sales period of at least 10 years or 15 years or whatever it is. So that's the other thing to keep in mind when you're looking at these terms is, What do I know of this publisher's reputation or this company's reputation? How have they behaved in the past? How do they seem to be making decisions? Do they seem to be collaborative? And then the other thing is maintain open lines of communication with whomever you contract with. It should never be a sign it and we never talk again. You should always be talking to them about how things are going, sharing information about how you're progressing with your work, asking for information about how they're progressing with theirs. Have that open line of communication so that when it comes time for things like, hey, I really want to do a second book. You said that sales don't justify you publishing it right now. What if I did a Kickstarter and I raised X amount of dollars? Mm-hmm. Would that justify, would you be able to use your distribution contacts if I could say cover the cost of, you know, printing 10,000 books? Because you'll get better results if you can be collaborative like that with the other party. And you know, if they can't do it, they'll say no. But because they have a relationship with you and they know what it's like to communicate with you, they're probably going to be more inclined to say, yeah, go ahead and do your Kickstarter. I don't care. That's totally fine. I can, mm-hmm. I trust you. I know what it's like to work with you.
Yeah. I know it was a throwaway example on Brad's part, but the Kickstarter one's an interesting example because I've seen more and more small to middle-sized publishers going, actually, we do want you to do a Kickstarter, and we're going to be the secret force behind that Kickstarter in the sense that you will be the public face of the Kickstarter, but we will be the ones actually publishing the books and fulfilling the books. And we will also at the same time this will be a test run for how big the print run should be for retailers and the like. It's interesting to see that sort of thing quietly start to happen more and more, I've noticed in comments.
Yeah, I've definitely done a couple of those deals, and they can be beneficial, but it is kind of a brave new world. It is a different way of structuring how the book gets made. And so you definitely want to talk to somebody or work with somebody where the communication is very open. I've had a couple situations where, you know, again, assumptions come into play. Somebody decided to do a Kickstarter and they made certain assumptions about how it would work. And then those don't come to fruition. And it is genuinely frustrating to find out late in the game that, this isn't going to happen, or the publisher's not going to actually handle this part of the process. So I would say a lot of times I notice folks in comics won't ask questions because they don't want to appear unprofessional or uninformed.
Yes.
And I totally get that. I completely understand where that comes from. But if you are going to be signing a contract with somebody, you have to feel comfortable asking them questions. If you do not feel comfortable asking them questions, how are you going to feel comfortable working with them? And if you're noticing that you have a lot of questions, I would say that that's a even better indication that maybe you need to talk to a lawyer, and maybe a lawyer who has experience in the industry, because they can answer some of the, you know, the basic general questions about how contracts work and what the industry like is. And then you can focus the specific questions about, are you going to do X or do I have to take care of it to the publisher or the potential partner that you're considering working with?
Right. I mean, even in this case, Brad's, it's nice to have Brad's concern about first right of refusal. It's interesting to hear your contextualized response of like, well, yes, it is a concern, but within a broader scope of a contract, here's why it can work. And mm-hmm. that, you know, even just having the experience of a lawyer who's looked at hundreds of contracts versus maybe the half dozen that Brad and I have looked at, you know, that kind of
right.
thing. Is helpful in terms of like, no, this is normal. We can absolutely tinker with the language a little bit, but this broadly speaking is a normal clause or that kind of thing. Even that's helpful. I've found from a lawyer being like, calm down, Dave, everything's fine. Slow it down.
It's going to be okay.
But they're trying to steal from me, Katie, they're trying to just slow it down, David. David, bring it down a notch.
Well, and I get it, right? Because like, you're not creating comics because you want to test out three ideas and see how they fly. It's not like other forms of entrepreneurship where you're interested in the business part of it. And so the widget doesn't matter. No. And when you're making comics, the comics matter. Like that, the art is the thing. You don't want to just slot in some answer. But in order to figure out what's going to work best for you, you have to be able to look at things and say, okay, is this a risk I'm willing to take? One of the things that I find, I understand where it comes from, but I find it frustrating is when people say, always do this or never do that. You know, just like we were talking about with the work for hire thing, because there might be a situation where it is perfectly fine to agree to write a first refusal, right? Like, not that big of a deal. Is being able to control the rights forever and ever, amen, and take them all over the place is not the goal of this particular project, so that's okay. But that might not be true for a different project. And so having an attorney who can help you evaluate the risks that are presented in a particular deal and decide what the right thing is better than trying to be perfect and follow the advice of always and never. I think that is actually, that discourages people from creating, and it discourages people from getting involved because they're convinced that they're going to make a mistake that's going to tear everything down. Mm-hmm. And that's very rare, very, very, very rarely is that ever going to be the case.
Dave, I know that you can confirm this, Dave. What's the question? What's the legal question or the legal concern you get at comic conventions from young creators more than any other legal concern?
Oh, I love it when Brad. I love it when Brad sets me up with an answer that I don't have.
It starts with an E and it ends with an S.
So, Dave, you know this, Dave. It starts with a W. It starts with a W, David. We
three
about
syllables.
This.
First syllable. Sound
David,
like.
Hold on. I'm going to sound out. In the meantime, he's doing like mime in the background.
We've talked about this before. Every one of them walks up and they're scared to put anything on the web because they're certain that as soon as they do, someone's going to steal it from them. They're going to steal their copyright. Yes. How do I put something on the web without having it
Wait
stolen?
A second. How does that start with an E?
Oh, no. I was just, I that was, that's an ongoing running gag.
Dang
I did
it,
that
Brad,
to him once
to
with exclusive
e
content.
Extraordinary theft, I guess is what it was. No, Brad has this habit as a friend of all being like, you know this, David. It starts with a G and it ends with an S.
Another word in public. I'm gonna quiz you on it.
It rhymes with myopic. Come on, you know this one. And every time I'm like, Brad, I don't know. Stop doing this to me. You know this. It rhymes with brontosaurus. Come on, Brad. I don't know. Come on, David. It has four syllables. Brad, stop it. I don't know.
Now, I'm not that obsequious, am I? I don't talk like that.
Only
I?
When you have your briefcase.
I was going to say, as soon as I hear the clack clack of your briefcase opening, then I know I'm in trouble. He puts on his reading glasses at the bridge of his nose, and he's like, now you know this, David.
It's like tapping my ruler on your desk.
Yeah. Well, no. So, yes, everyone is afraid of having their copyright stolen or their work stolen in the form of someone stealing their mm-hmm. copyright, and they don't have the legal staff to fight Disney. That goes back to Katie's response, though, that we are not doing A/B product testing. It's not like we're just selling T-shirts and do people like the blue one or the red one. When someone puts their comics up, sometimes it's the one very personal story right now for them that, and nothing else could replace it. So I get the fear that people are like, oh, some big company's going to steal my idea. But yes, Brad, that to answer your question, starting with a C and ending with a T, copyright. People are always concerned about copyright. Come on, David, it rhymes with Smoppy Bite. You know this one.
Well, listen, on that note, we have absolutely obliterated another hour here at Comic Lab, and we've got so much more things we want to talk about. Katie, can we have you back on the show sometime in the future and maybe actually talk a little bit about copyright?
I would love that. That would be fantastic.
Fantastic.
Well, and don't forget, for people that haven't yet become a patron of the show on patreon.com/comiclab, Katie will also be joining us for this week's Pro Tips, which is a totally separate, super exclusive. You guys know this. It starts with a P and it ends with a T. It's a podcast. It's an exclusive podcast that we give out just to who. It starts with a P, ends with an S. It's a patrons. Patrons get it. So Katie will be joining us for the Pro Tips podcast as well. And so you'll want to what? You want to start with a J, ends with an N. You want to join us over
you'll
there.
You'll want to join. That's and, right.
I don't know why. Now I'm doing this as a runner and it's not funny anymore.
My cheeks hurt.
So anyway, but lest you have forgotten, first of all, Brad and I have used Katie, gosh, 3, 4, 5 times contractually, and I cannot recommend her enough. So as a pro and as a friend, I will recommend Katie's services. But if you're curious, you can also check her out at workmadeforhire.net. And also, don't forget to go over and check her out on Skillshare. And what's the phrase to search on Skillshare?
The series of classes is called Contracts for Creative Freelancers. And I'm basically breaking down different aspects of reviewing contracts that come up when you are a creative freelancer. So there's a class right now about how to fix bad terms, like how to actually go through and identify some terms that I notice come up over and over again and how to fix them. There's a class about how work for hire works, and there's going to be a class coming out about payment terms. What are good terms and what are bad terms and what you should be paying attention to. So if you are a member of Skillshare, you can go over and
I'm looking at
check
it right
it out.
Now and it is fantastic.
Thank you.
I'm looking at it right now and it's fantastic. This really looks great. And they're bite-sized chunks here. I'm seeing like contracts for creative freelancers. Should you do work for hire is like 29 minutes. That's the perfect length of time, like the 20 to 45 minute time before people start to zone out, especially on something that they might not be super familiar with. This is perfect.
Yeah, just because I love it doesn't mean you're going to love it. So I tried to make them shorter, and they're broken down into a couple videos too, so you can sort of take it, do it at your own pace.
That's brilliant.
Oh, I love this. And I've also said this a million times. I go to Work Made for Hire to read your blog constantly because you have a really great way of making some of this intimidating language and concepts more approachable and understandable for somebody like me who does not come naturally to the topic. You do a really great job of breaking that down, and I love your blog for it.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Well, along those lines, Dave, I'm afraid we're going to have to say that you've been listening to Comic Lab, the show about making comics and making a living from comics.
Your hosts have been, and you know this, it starts with a B, it ends with a D. It's Brad Geiger, the editor of webcomics.com and cartoonist of Evil Inc. at evil-comic.com.
And we've talked about this so much, Dave. I know that you know this. It's right on the tip of your tongue. It starts with a D. It ends with a K. It's Dave
Steven?
Kellett. And he's
Kellett.
The co-director of Stripped and the cartoonist of Sheldon at SheldonComics.com and Drive at DriveComics.com.
And the Comic Lab theme song is used with permission from Andy Creighton at theworldrecord.net. And this episode was edited by Matt Woodard of Woodsong Productions at www.woodsong.media.
And our guest this week has been Katie Lane. You can check her stuff out at workmadeforhire.net. Comic Lab is made possible by your support on patreon.com/comiclab. So we'll go ahead and say that twice. patreon.com/comiclab. Okay, I'm hearing something like, it sounds like a knocking, like somebody standing outside knocking on the door.
Oh, did you hear this?
Did you hear that? Oh, is that the workers outside your house, Dave?
No, that's my fat butt on my chair, but thank you, Brad. I appreciate that. That's very kind of you to point that out. I'm hearing something that sounds like creaking, like a chair that can barely hold the weight. It must be construction workers, because most chairs could hold a human body. There's no way a chair could creak like that.
It sounds like 1,000 screws crying out in agony.
Man, we're just friendship all over the place this morning.
No wood, most wood could carry hundreds and hundreds of pounds. There's no way wood could cry like that under the weight of a human body.
I've never heard pleather groan in my life.
By the way, I hit record, so this is great.
This is now officially advice.